So for the second matter on our calendar this morning, we will be reconstituting the panel, so there'll just be a slight delay, but we will proceed forward shortly. If the attorneys are here for the second matter on our calendar, you may take your place at council table.
Thank you.
And please take your time to settle in, pour your glasses of water, arrange your materials. But while you're doing that, I'll ask the marshal to call the case so that we can have a complete record.
Case A19-1453, Jeffrey J. Walker et al. Appellants versus Minnesota Commissioner of Management and Budget respondent.
All right, and counsel, I'll just make a few quick remarks. Again, take whatever time you need to get yourself oriented at the podium, including making adjustments to the microphone so we can hear your remarks. And if you'd like to raise or lower the podium, the lectern, you can do that. There's a button just underneath. Hopefully you can find that, counsel, if you'd like to use it. I can tell you're a little taller than the lawyers who were before you. And then I'll just remind you one thing. I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures, but we do have a recording of today's proceedings, and we would appreciate it if you would identify yourself for the record before you start your remarks, as well as the client that you are here representing. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Very good. Thank you very much. Good morning, Judge Bradford. Judge Reyes, Judge Johnson. My name is John Eric Kingstead. I am the attorney for Jeffrey J. Walker and Walker Properties of Woodbury, 2 LLC, the appellants in this matter. And may it please the court, our case here is involving a complex, somewhat intricate interpretation of a fairly broad and fairly broadly stated statute, Minnesota Statutes 284.28 subdivisions 7 to 13. I stumble over that sometimes trying to say all those subdivisions because it's really separate and apart from subdivisions 1 through 6, I think, and they sort of are somewhat of a divided kind of idea. But to begin, I guess I'd like to establish first that this is a case of first impression, I do believe, notwithstanding what the commissioner has argued. A case of first impression because this court, notwithstanding, he's also the McCharles versus State Department of Revenue case decided in 1998, did not really address the substantive terms that are being addressed in this case. That case simply involved an interpretation of whether or not the repurchase of tax-forfeited land would be subject to a claim under the statute. The court ruled that it was not, basically, but then included some other language that I think that's been confused here to throw the case into a little bit of a quandary about whether or not the plain language of the statute, its legislative history and so forth, really pertain to the statute at all. But nevertheless, and I also would like to establish, too, that this is really the first time my clients have been, and I'm going to refer to my clients as Jeffrey Walker, just Walker, and he has been before the court presenting a claim for recovery of illegally excessive and illegal unconstitutional taxes and for the value of the property that was in excess of the penalties, the unpaid taxes, penalties, special assessments, and interest that were in fact imposed but were paid off in full by the tax forfeited property. The properties were valued according to the record, which is in this case as well, 14 parcels of Oakview 4th edition at approximately $80,000. A piece, which coming to over $1.12 million, and which was an equal or in excess of the amount of the penalties, the unpaid taxes, special assessments, penalties, and interest that were due and owing at the time.
Counsel,
those matters were paid off. Those taxes and so forth were paid off.
Counsel, you referred to this issue as one of first impression, but is it really? Because aren't these claims being brought now precluded by Walker 3 under collateral estoppel and res judicata?
Well, I'd like to get to that later, Your Honor, but I'll address it briefly right now. Is that the statute, I think, Judge Freeman, in her decision, said collateral estoppel barred my client's case, which actually was under my client's was claim was under paragraph 8 of the amended complaint, which was a claim for material failure, omission, error, or defect in the proceedings under the tax forfeiture laws. Now, paragraph 8 of the amended complaint was under the laws relating to the taxation of land. Walker 3 only addressed the question of the tax forfeiture laws, and I'll get to that back, if you will, Your Honor, to get to that in my subsequent arguments here. I just want to get back to talking about the laws relating to the taxation of land, because that's really I think that's substantially what my client's claim in paragraph 7 of the amended complaint asserts. And a recovery here is seeking the value of the land of the parcels over $3 million, which we assert is over $3 million, which is far in excess of the $1.12 million that were claimed in those penalties and interest. Furthermore, the penalties and interest and special assessments included over $300,000 of illegal and unconstitutional exactions, including an $88,500 major roadway assessment by the City of Woodbury, which this court held to be an illegal tax in Harstead versus City of Woodbury in 2017, and which the Supreme Court affirmed in 2018 in the same case. So at least $88,500, we believe, is coming back to my clients, as well as another over $300,000 of the $585,000 in special assessments which were imposed. These include, for example, trunk and sewer charges, fees or charges or exactions, and storm sewer charges or assessments that were not stated or were not shown to have any kind of nexus to my client's property or to his subdivision development, and which had no kind of nexus and was not determined to be roughly proportional, as the Supreme Court has ruled as required in the Coons case. It's just by this kind of, but because of this, I guess I would say that I don't want to really have to get into, I don't think we have to get into the evaluation of whether or not the law, the statutes 284.28 subdivision 7 is limited only to tax forfeiture laws relating to tax forfeiture, because the district court, and Walker agrees with this point made by the district court, that the statute has to be construed in pari materia with other laws relating to the taxation of land.
Well, and before you get into that, counsel, I want to ask a question on 284. Is that statute ambiguous or not?
It is ambiguous, Your Honor. I think not.
Why is it ambiguous? What are the two reasonable interpretations of that statute? And what specific language are you saying is ambiguous?
I'd say what's ambiguous is what laws specifically are related to the taxation of land, and what duties are imposed under laws relating to taxation of land upon public officers or employees.
So what language under the statute are you arguing it has more than one reasonable interpretation?
Well, I think the whole statute has more than one reasonable interpretation, but it's not.
The reason why I want to clarify this is it seems like you're arguing both that it's ambiguous and we need to look at legislative history, and that it's unambiguous and we need to only look at the plain meaning of the statute. So I'm trying to figure out, because that's the first question we need to ask.
Okay.
Is this ambiguous or not? And if it's ambiguous, it's only ambiguous if there's more than one reasonable interpretation. And what language do you argue has more than one reasonable interpretation in the statute? What specific language?
Well, any material failure, omission, error, or defect by any public officer or employee in the performance of the officer and employee's duties under the laws relating to the taxation of land or forfeiture thereof. That's ambiguous, I agree. Now, if
okay, excuse, so excuse what me. What are the two interpretations of that first phrase of the statute that you...
Interpretations? Well, I guess the two interpretations would be, does this include... I guess the two interpretations I don't think it's a reasonable interpretation, but one interpretation is that it only applies to tax forfeiture, laws relating to tax forfeiture.
Well, it says relating to the taxation of land or forfeiture thereof.
Yes.
So
I don't think it's ambiguous in that sense. No, I think it's not ambiguous in terms of reading out laws relating to taxation of land, which is what the commissioner and the attorney general are arguing.
Well, it's relating to the taxation of land or forfeiture thereof.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. I think that is ambiguous, but it's not ambiguous to the point of saying, well, we'll just read it all out. I guess the plain language rule, says you can't really do that either.
No, but in order for it to be interpreted as being ambiguous, there has to be at least two or more reasonable interpretations of that.
All right.
And if not, then we just look at the plain meaning. So I'm struggling as to what the two or more reasonable interpretations of that language are. How could it seems pretty clear, relating to the taxation of land or forfeiture thereof. I guess
one reasonable interpretation would be that it only applies to property taxes, strictly speaking, within the bounds of, let's say, Chapter 272 to 279 or 282, let's say, those statutes that pertain to property taxation per se and would not perhaps pertain to special assessments of land in Chapter 429 or any other kind of, or Chapter 462, for example, which also relating to the taxation of land in the sense of that they are brought in through the special assessment process. It could be ambiguous in that way. I think it would be a reasonable interpretation to say that it does not include the special assessments of land, or maybe it does not include fees or exactions.
But relating to is fairly broad language, though.
Excuse me?
Relating to is fairly broad language, though, and there's no language in there saying except for special assessments or...
That's correct, yes. And I guess I would say, yeah, relating to is ambiguous. And I think I was responding to the point the court made that, relating to I don't think is ambiguous because I think we have the Supreme Court case and there's a Supreme Court case I said, it escaped my mind at the moment, but that case held that relating to taxation of fees, exactions, and so forth is not ambiguous, and it clearly, that part of it really clearly incorporates other statutes outside of the relating to language. Now, this statute was not specifically under review, but the relating to was used in a different context involving a similar kind of setup here that I think pertains to the kind of interpretation, and it also pertains to the chapter section 645.44 subdivision 19, which defines fees as including any kind of taxes or any kind of charge that would be imposed. Now, that's I think where the ambiguity comes in, is whether or not those fees and other charges are to be included as taxes where they're labeled, simply labeled as such by a municipality, as the city of Woodbury did here. So
when were those, in your view, when were those taxes, fees, or charges assessed or imposed?
They were imposed in October of 2005 as a condition of my client's approval of the subdivision. In July, subject to my client's execution of a development agreement.
So why didn't you or your client bring these claims in the 2007 action?
My client appealed the assessments, the 2007 action is separate from Walker 1, where my client appealed the special assessments, which were not specifically addressed in the 2007 action, which was filed, incidentally, by the city of Woodbury. My client did not file that. That was an appeal that was filed by the city of Woodbury. They filed in a response to a dismissal of a claim that my client had filed in December of 2005. But the appeal was taken properly from the special assessments, which were included the exactions of $300,000 plus that I've mentioned here, plus another $200,000 of improvements.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but since time is short, am I correct? This is the fourth case between the parties, right? Or fourth case concerning this property?
Fourth case, yes, yes.
And could this claim have been brought either as a claim or a counterclaim in the second or third case?
Well, my client attempted to bring my client contested the special assessments in Walker 1. The Cash case was dismissed without prejudice because of the city's attempt to oppose the my client's previously served but not filed claim contesting the development agreement. That case went on as Walker 2 until the case was dismissed in 2012 and then appealed to this court in Walker 2 in 2013 and decided in 2013. Now, my client was not allowed to bring any kind of takings claim or any kind of claim there. My client was simply there attempting to contest the validity of that the development agreement.
And then in the county's quiet title action, you brought counterclaims.
We tried to do that.
Concerning the assessments.
Yes. Those were automatically dismissed by virtue of the fact my client did not pay the special assessments into court. That case was brought, by the way, while this case was pending before, Walker 2 was pending before this court. So my client really did not have a full and fair opportunity to litigate these matters, and it is my client's claims that it's always were unjustly imposed, and the illegal exaction, for example, the major roadway special assessment, is an illegal tax. My client had to pay it, and that was something I think he's entitled to a refund of under due process that we've mentioned in our case in our briefs.
So the facts on which your claims are based, the allegations are all of those. Were all of those facts known to your client back in 2005?
All of the facts, no, because we didn't have, for example, the Coons case. We didn't have the Harstead.
Well, that's case law. But what about the facts? The underlying facts on which the claims are based, the allegations in the complaints.
My client was attempting to resist, was opposing the payment. My client put up his property as he was encumbered his property. He did everything he was told to basically comply as much as well as he could, subject to his contesting of the excessive charges and so forth that were imposed by the city of Woodbury in 2005, yes. And we say that, you know, there's still time because he resulted in his property being tax forfeited, that we can still bring a claim. There's a 10-year statute of limitations after the expiration of the period of redemption, which I think the statute allows a claim for the taking or a deprivation of land under those circumstances. Now, and for the unjust deprivation, we say that's unjust, and we think that claim should be heard. Because my client paid too much, over $3 million to pay $1 million. He's entitled to that back, and he's entitled to the $300,000 in excess fees and exactions that were illegally and unconstitutionally exacted from him in violation of the Constitution.
So, counsel, not to interrupt you mid-sentence, we appreciate the arguments and comments that you've made. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. If it may please the court, my name is Christine Nogosik, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent. I want to focus my arguments today on two issues, and both of these issues, I think, are at the crux of this case, at least in the viewpoint of the respondent. And the first that I would like to address is the issue of whether or not the decision in what I refer to, and I think of what both parties are commonly referring to as Walker 3, which is the county's quiet title action. And the district court at least granted the respondent's motion to dismiss in part based on Walker 3's decision. And when you look at what the trial court or district court did in Walker 3 is it was tasked with the job of making sure that the county's forfeiture of the Walker property for non-payment of property taxes complied in all respects with the property tax forfeiture statutes. The court looked very closely at the record, which was submitted to the court on stipulated facts, and looked at that stipulation of facts to make sure that the county sent out all of the notices at the proper time to the right people or individuals or entities using the right form of service, whether that be certified mail, published, posted, personal. And the court, when it looked at that record, said the County of Washington lawfully forfeited the property and made a conclusion to that effect and held that the forfeiture of the property was lawful and that the state owned the all title and interest to that property exclusive of any interest held in the property by Walker Property. Now, also at issue in Walker 3, and I think the panel has picked up on this, was a series of counterclaims that Walker Properties had asserted against the county to defend against the forfeiture of the property. And those counterclaims arose out of the same facts or nucleus facts that are being argued here, that there was something incorrect, unlawful, violated Walker Properties' constitutional rights in how the city specially assessed the property. Now, those are very similar claims, if not the same claims, that were brought in either Walker 1 or Walker 2. So what we see here is a theme that started way back in 2006 when Walker Properties started the first litigation, claiming that the special assessments, the development agreement, were unlawful, and that the this somehow violated the constitutional rights. So we have a case in 2006. We have another case in 2007, which came up to this court twice. Then we have Walker 3, which had Walker Properties in the defense position, but asserting counterclaims regarding these special assessments. That case, again, was decided against Walker Properties, as the first two had been. That case, Walker 3, came up to this court. The court affirmed the conclusion that the state's, that the forfeiture was lawful and the state had title to the property. We now have a fourth lawsuit. And I think when you look at the history of these claims, what you see is that Walker Properties and Mr. Walker is continually trying to seek against different entities, different government entities, under using different claims, relief for the same set of facts.
The Walker 3 case, though, the counterclaims that were asserted by Walker did not include Subdivision 7. I'm going to call it that, 284.28 Subdivision 7 claim.
Right. That is correct.
Yeah. So can you give me your analysis on that? How because I assume you're leading up to res judicata and collateral estoppel. At least it sounds like it. So
I am. I am, Your Honor. So the Subdivision 7, and this is going to kind of intertwine to whether or not kind of the scope of relief under Subdivision 7. So I will come back to your question, Your Honor. The position of the respondent is that Subdivision 7 provides only an avenue to recover for unjust deprivation of property that arises out of a defect in the forfeiture of the property. And because we have Walker 3's decision that has already analyzed and determined that the county checked every box that it was required to check in order to reach the determination that the property was lawfully forfeited, that that contains a claim for Subdivision 7, and that the decision from Walker 3 is that because Walker 3 said it's lawful, there can't be this secondary or the second claim for recovery on that same set of facts.
Did you argue to the district court that both claims should be dismissed based on res judicata?
Your Honor, I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you mean by both,
well,
both claims.
District court seemed to recognize two different claims, one alleged in paragraph 7, one alleged in paragraph 8. Seems like District Court dealt with the first one on the merits, and the second one found that it was precluded.
So,
I was wondering if you argued preclusion with respect to both claims.
Your Honor, as far as the bucket of claims that fall into claims arising from the conduct of the city officials, that being one set of claims, the respondent argued at the district court and argues here today that, first of all, Subdivision 7 provides no recovery for those claims, but alternatively, that those claims would be precluded from the Walker 3 decision because those claims were dismissed because they were brought as counterclaims in Walker 3.
So you argued that as an alternative argument with respect to that claim?
Yes.
And then you argued it as a primary argument, preclusion as a primary argument against the second claim?
Yes, but again, Your Honor, there's a little bit of a twist or a nuance there because the preclusion claim for the claim that there was a defect in the county's forfeiture is not based on the dismissal of those claims or those counterclaims in Walker 3, but the fact that the court made an affirmative decision that the forfeiture was lawful. So, yes, it's
more collateral estoppel?
Correct. It's very important to understand that the claims that Mr. Walker and his company, Walker Properties, are asserting against the respondent are claims that should have been brought against the city. And these claims were brought against the city. And when you, it's unfortunate, but it's true that they were brought, but they were unsuccessful. And the reason why they need to be brought against the city and not the respondent, the Commissioner of Management, Minnesota Management and Budget, is because there's a statute that deals with special assessments. And 429.081 says that it is the exclusive remedy for a property owner to contest a city special assessments. Then there's other provisions where a property owner, such as the appellants here, can contest a development agreement or the fees that are imposed under a development agreement. Those rights to contest those type of fees are contained in Chapter 2 subdivisions of Chapter 462. So the appellants here did have the ability to contest these special assessments. And they did try to contest them. They were unsuccessful against the city. They're now just moving their emphasis to another defendant. But the statute that they're moving under doesn't provide them the recovery they're looking for. They need to look to the city, and they need to do that properly under the right statute provisions. Before I conclude, I do want to get back to delve a little bit deeper into the question of whether Section 284.28 Subdivision 7 provides a avenue for recovery for the city officials' actions, as the appellants are contending here.
Could I interrupt just a minute? At the outset, you said you wanted to focus on two issues, and I'm not sure if you identified the second. Is this it?
This is it, Your Honor.
Okay,
thank you.
Yep.
This is the second issue. And the appellants seem to believe that this, or they argue that this court's decision in McCharles isn't binding, it isn't applicable to this case. And the respondent disagrees with that. And the reason why is that when you look at the analysis that this court did in the McCharles case is it specifically looked at the provision we are dealing with and the particular words, the words relating to the taxation of land or forfeiture thereof, and looked at whether or not the respondents in the case, the McCharles, the property owners, whether their claim that there was a defect in their processing of the application for their repurchase, whether that was relating to the taxation of land. And this court went through the analysis of what do those words mean? Now, ultimately, the court in McCharles back in 1998 determined that the term relating to was ambiguous and moved on to look at the legislative history of Section 284.28. And when it looked at the language in Subdivision 7, and it saw parallel language in Subdivisions 1 and 2, the court correctly concluded that a cause of action to recover under Subdivision 7 had to be related to the defects occurring in the tax forfeiture process. That case, McCharles, should be, if not binding, should be instructive here. Now, arguably, the case in McCharles dealt with conduct of city or county officials post-forfeiture, where we're dealing with conduct of city officials pre-forfeiture. But the conclusion should be the same. Both conduct that is being complained of is occurring outside of the tax forfeiture process. And because the McCharles court correctly concluded that a claim under Subdivision 7 has to arise out of a defect of the tax forfeiture, the court could and should look to the McCharles case and say, we're going to apply that rule here and determine that because the claims giving rise to the Subdivision 7 are due to the city officials' conduct in 05 and 06, that's outside of the forfeiture process, and there's no avenue for recovery under Subdivision 7.
So I understand your argument on McCharles to say, so again, I'm relying in part on the district court's interpretation of Walker's complaint, which had two theories, one relating, as you just described, to the conduct in 2005, 2006 on special assessments and the development agreement, and then the other related to the forfeiture process. So just looking at the 2005-2006 special assessment period, you're saying Subdivision 7 does not provide a remedy for that type of a claim, right?
Correct.
Now, if we hadn't had Walker 3, because I hear you as saying Walker 3 pretty much takes out the claim related to the later forfeiture proceedings. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I know you make other arguments too, but that's one of them.
Right.
Right. So, but you aren't claiming Subdivision 7. Say in, 2007, Walker had attempted to bring a Subdivision 7 claim for the special assessment, just in theory. Would that have been possible? You'd say no, not under McCharles, right?
We would say no, not under McCharles.
Okay, but say in 2013, Walker had brought, this is after the forfeiture process had, I think, gone to full completion, because I think the state got title in, 2012, 2013, something like that. So say Walker had brought a Subdivision 7 claim in 2014. Would that claim have been viable at that point without, our lengthy history of Walker, 2, 3 decisions?
I think I'm understanding your question, and I think I'm
asking
can
you to set aside the res judicata and collateral estoppel analysis.
So, keeping with the theme of two buckets of claims, one claim that has to do with the conduct of the city officials, that claim, the respondent argues, could never survive because Subdivision 7 doesn't provide for a avenue of recovery for claims that occur outside of the forfeiture process. Now let's say we don't have Walker 3, and Mr. Walker brings a claim under Subdivision 7 saying there has been a defect in the tax forfeiture process. For example, as he's claiming here, that there was a failure to properly serve the notice of the expiration of the redemption period. If we didn't have the decision of Walker 3, That would be a claim of a defect that occurred during the tax forfeiture proceeding. That would be a claim that would that Subdivision 7 would provide an avenue for recovery.
But that would only provide an avenue of recovery because Walker 3 said the county has checked all of its boxes, including notice, but up until then, that notice issue hadn't been decided. So that would have, under Subdivision 7, in terms of the procedural steps that had to be undertaken, that would have been an open question at that point?
I think I'm understanding your question, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the claim of a defect in the tax forfeiture proceeding that Mr. Walker is claiming in this case would be a viable claim if we didn't have Walker 3.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think I did want to get back to the, I think the part that I didn't really address in my initial arguments here in response to Judge Reyes' question had to do with res judicata and collateral estoppel, especially on our subdivision, paragraph 8 claim for, which is the failure to comply with the laws relating to tax forfeiture. Minnesota statute section 281.23 subdivision 6 says that not only does the county or the tax forfeiture proceeding have to serve by certified mail, it also has to take the second step where the lands are not vacant and unoccupied to start the procedure by service of a summons personally, in the manner of the service of a summons. The Minnesota Supreme Court has consistently held in cases going back to 1906, right up to the Weathers versus Anderson case, and I think it's 1973, and I don't think there have been any cases, or maybe there's 1980, in the 1980s there may have been a case like McHenry case, but those cases have all held that strict compliance is required under to effectuate a tax forfeiture. Failure to serve the summons where the property is not vacant and unoccupied, which the sheriff of Washington County in this case found it was, and that was incorrect, that was a failure error. That is a defect that would authorize before these statutes were changed, that would authorize up to that point in time an attack on the state's tax title. Chapter 1977 Minnesota laws, chapter 265, section 1, changed the laws that was in existence up to that time to basically bifurcate this, to create a new subdivision 7 to allow a new claim for unjust deprivation of land or tax forfeiture thereof. But to recognize and to also to basically cut off attacks on state tax titles to protect the marketability of state tax titles, but then to create a very broad provision to allow the recovery of for unjust deprivation of land. It changed the language from wrongful deprivation to unjust deprivation, involving the very broad language we have today.
But couldn't this issue have been raised in Walker 3, though?
That was not addressed.
That wasn't the question. The question is, couldn't the argument that you're making now, couldn't that have been raised in Walker 3?
Actually, I did raise this argument, although the case, we did not raise the specific issue of the failure to serve or the failure
right,
the vacant. We did not raise that issue.
Right, that's my point. That wasn't raised, but that could have been raised in Walker 3, correct?
No,
to
it couldn't.
To challenge.
No, it could not have, Yara, because, and here's the reason why, and I'm going to guess that raises my next point. This court has interpreted under the Hamburg case, Franklin versus Hennepin County, and Harstead versus Mound, Inc., substantial compliance is okay if you're attacking a state tax title and applying the policy of the state in sections 279.001, parens A, up through 284.28, subdivision 1A, that says that the statutes there to protect the tax title, the marketability of tax titles, have to be liberally construed. Substantial compliance is okay if the tax title is at issue. Our argument here is that where the tax title is not an issue, as under subdivision 7 through 13, as under the new statute that was created in 1977, that can be disregarded. Substantial compliance, strict compliance is not required. That issue was not raised, could not have been raised, because we agreed that Judge McBride and Judge Freeman properly found substantial compliance. That's not enough, however. We say you disregard the whole idea of liberal construction to protect the marketability. Now the question is there a material defect, error, omission, or other defect in the proceedings involving tax forfeiture? And that the answer is absolutely not. As a matter of law, as I've indicated in my brief, The county did not comply strictly with the statute because they did not, they first determined improperly that the case that the property was vacant and unoccupied. It was not. And two, they failed to serve my client with a summons. So therefore, my client still essentially has an outstanding, you might say, adverse possessory interest, which is, I think, protected. And that's one of the things that was cut off and one of the reasons we're seeking a compensation here. And incidentally, I think that issue about the compensation, there's two points here. We are looking to get recovery of the excessively paid illegal taxes that were imposed beyond the special assessments. The state is going to still be able to keep the payments that were compensated. Those were not issue. We're seeking the recovery of the illegal, the $300,000-plus illegal or unconstitutional exactions imposed previously, and the excess of the amount over those amounts that were imposed by taking about $3 million, according to a going concern value of the property, in excess of those improperly taken, or in excess of the taxes, special assessments, penalties, and interest. And I guess I'm running out of time here. I can't address all the other arguments, but I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. And of course, we have full briefing on this, and we're grateful for your briefed arguments as well as the oral argument today. So this matter is now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you so much.
Thank you.